Here in chapter 11, in verse number 7, is it when the Jews went out, ulechol bnei Israel lo yecheratz kelev lishono, which means that no dog will bark when the Jews will be passing by to leave, to go out of the land of Egypt. So simply it's taken as some case like a metaphor. Of course, that means that nobody will bother you, no Egyptian will bother you. So we just say, like, no dog will bark at you, but that's not the focus, that's not the point. However, in one of the commentaries, he says that we find in the Talmud, Baba Kama, that dogs have a sixth sense. So again, it's in Talmud. The Talmud says like this, Baba Kama, Daf Samach, it says like this, that when there is like a special, like a death in the town, he says, dogs will sense it. And when there is a presence, you know, there's such a thing like a semi-prophetic state of the presence of Elijah. Did you ever hear the presence of Elijah is like a semi-prophetic state? If in the town there is a vision, somebody has, the dogs will sense it. That's what he says. That's what the Talmud says. So this commentary says, therefore, when the Torah mentions the dog not doing anything, it's not just a metaphor. It's specifically dogs, which means that the dogs had that sixth sense which told them, don't bother the Jews. Right? And the interesting thing is that I saw an article that they are making experiments in China concerning the intuition of the dogs concerning earthquakes. It's an incredible thing. That they sense that the dogs start acting differently right before earthquakes. It's an amazing thing how it, you know, that what the Gemara says, that they have a sixth sense. Let's go into chapter 12. Vayomer Hashem al Moshe vel Aaron beretz Mitzrayim lemor. Hashem says to Moshe and Aaron, Hachodesh hazeh lachem rosh chadashim. This month, the month which is starting now, this is the month of Nisan, is Rosh Chadashim, the head, the first of all the months. So now we have a very strange calendar. If we ask, when is the beginning of the year in days, which one is the first day of the year? The Rosh Hayomim, right, in the Jewish calendar. Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah is the beginning of the year, right? Rosh Hashanah. But if we talk about months, it's not Tishrei. Rosh Hashanah is in the month of Tishrei. But Tishrei is not the first month. Right? The first month is Nisan. But the first day of the year, that's Rosh Hashanah. When was this established? Right now. Up to now, it was Tishrei. Because according to our tradition, this is when the world is established. That's the birth of the world. But now, this is the birth of the Jewish people. And the birth of the Jewish people, the Jewish nation, is right now. So therefore, the month of Nisan has some connection with the Jewish people. The same way that the first day of the year has a connection with the whole universe, the month of Nisan has a connection with the Jewish people. This is when they became a nation. HaChodesh hazeh lachem rosh chadashim. Rishon hu lachem lechodshei hashana. So according to the simple interpretation of this verse, what God is telling Moshe is to start the calendar now. That's all, which means there was a month of Nisan before, but it was always the seventh month. From now on, it's the first month. You know, it's when you write letters, right, you write first month. Is that the point? No, says the oral tradition. There is something more which is being established right now. The mitzvah of making the decision yourselves when the new month should be. Here, this is what is being established right now. That the Jews establish their own calendar, which means they have certain basic rules. The month can either have 29 or 30 days, not 31 or 28. But between 29 and 30 is completely your decision. This is included in this statement. Of course, they would have to, and there was a whole process. There was a whole process. What was the process? Originally, the people who saw the moon would have to come next morning to the court in Jerusalem, and testify, we saw the new moon. Right. And then it would be established. that today is the first day of the new month. Fine. I mean, it's a mitzvah. Eventually, we lost the capacity to do it. Right? The Israel was overrun, was conquered. So therefore, we lost the power to establish our own calendar. So we established certain rules, and it became automatic. But ideally, the Jews should establish every single month when the new moon is. Okay? Now, some people say, well, that means that at the time, Jews didn't have enough astronomical information to establish by themselves the new month. This is why they needed this system, the visual system. That's what some people mistakenly think. The counter argument to this is very, very simple. You see, it says clearly that in order for the month to be established, let's say, for instance, the witnesses came and they said, last night we saw the new moon, right? The court has to ask the witnesses, where did you see it? And they said, well, we saw it on the northeast corner, right, of the sky. What was the shape of the moon? This was the shape of the moon. Where was the opening towards? If all the details of their testimony coincides with the knowledge of the court, then we accept the testimony. But if the testimony of witnesses does not coincide with what they know, then we reject the witnesses. They are false witnesses. That means that they had to have pre-knowledge in order to ask the witnesses. So the question is, if they have that knowledge, why do they need the witnesses? They know already when it was supposed to appear. Do you follow the question? If you say that they needed the visual method because they lacked information, fine. Okay, but if we say that they didn't lack the information, just the opposite. If they lacked the information, they couldn't even accept the witnesses. In order to accept the witnesses, they had to know beforehand the astronomical information, where was it supposed to be seen? Because, for instance, it says, what about if in Jerusalem it was cloudy, right? And only in Bet Shemesh. Bet Shemesh, it wasn't cloudy. And a person walked from Bet Shemesh to Jerusalem in order to give testimony, right? So the court has to have astronomical knowledge of the exact position of the moon the night before. Otherwise, they can't accept it. Okay? So we have a big question here. Why the visual method when they already have the knowledge, the scientific method? Okay? So we'll put the question aside. We'll go on. Fine, but that's the question. I mean, Tamei, we are discussing Tamei HaTorah. Why does the Torah want from us? What's the idea behind it? The other question is, you know that in the oral tradition, we find the following statement. As a matter of fact, this is quoted in the first Rashi in Chumash, that really this should be the beginning of the Torah. The Torah shouldn't have started with Genesis. The Torah should have started with this verse, HaChodesh HaZeh Lachem Rosh Chodesh. You hear? It's a powerful statement. That's what it should have started. Because, why? Why is this so important? Because this is the beginning of Torah. Which means, that's the beginning of the information to the Jewish people about how they should act. Isn't that the point? What is Torah? Torah is not history. Torah is not geology, right? So what's the point of telling me how the world was created? The story of Abraham, that's history. Torah is what it sounds like. What does the Torah mean? Instruction. Instruction to a people. Where is the first time that we find instruction to a people? To a Jewish nation. This here. This is the first time God instructs the Jewish people how to act. And don't ask me, what about when God told Abraham do such and such? That's not to a people, that's to an individual. A nation, this is the first time that a nation gets instructions from God. Therefore, this is where the Torah should start. Okay? Now, it's amazing that the Torah should choose, of all mitzvahs, I mean, there are a lot of mitzvahs the Torah could have started with. So, of all the mitzvahs, this is chosen as the beginning of the Torah? Yeah?
You can't say that this was the first time.
You're right, but it sounds like
That is still, as far as Hashem is concerned, as far as God is concerned, they're not a nation yet. They are only a nation when they accept this commandment. That's what it sounds like. Right? Why? What's so special about this commandment? Shabbos it sounds more important. Shabbos. Right? There are so many. There are many others. No, this one is crucial. This is the essence of the whole relationship between Hashem and the Jewish people. Why? What's the idea behind it? So what? I hear. But so what? You know, why is... Okay, all right, but the Sabbath doesn't even require that. Right? It's all every seventh day, you don't have to calculate anything. Right, so why shouldn't the Sabbath be the first mitzvah? Yeah?
I think what you just said is something along the lines of the setting of time. Hashem's Baruch Hu, so to speak, is making us partners in creation.
That's exactly it, right. That's the idea. The idea behind it is the following. You know, it says in the prayers, we have a prayer for the Sabbath and we have a prayer for the holidays, for Rosh Chodesh, the beginning of the new month. And there is a crucial difference in the text of the blessing itself. By the Sabbath, we say, Baruch atah Hashem, blessed are you God, Mekadesh HaShabbat, the one who sanctifies the Sabbath. It's interesting. When we say the similar blessing concerning the holidays, or Rosh Chodesh, or the new month, we don't say that. We don't say Baruch Atah Hashem Mekadesh Azmanim, the different periods in time, or Mekadesh Chodeshim. We say Baruch Atah Hashem Mekadesh Yisrael, who sanctifies the Jewish people, the Rosh Chodeshim, and the new months. Why the Jewish people are mentioned when we mention the month and the holidays, but they are not mentioned when we mention the Sabbath. So, the commentaries say, because the sanctity of the Sabbath is independent of the Jew. It precedes the Jew. God sanctified the Sabbath when he created the world. That was the sanctification of the Sabbath. Then came the Jews into the world. So we came into the world into an existent sanctity. Now, we know that really there are basically three sanctities in this world, in the created world. God created three sanctities. There are three levels of sanctity. Kadosh, 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 right? Kadosh, Kadosh, Kadosh has a meaning concerning what Hashem created. God created sanctity in time, sanctity in space, and sanctity in people who live in time and space. Okay? So we say like this. First of all, we explain why is it so important that Hashem should sanctify time and space. Because He created it. He's the author. He's the creator of time and space. God is not subservient to time and space, which means that we reject the idea that time and space is eternally old. Because if time and space go back eternally, right, then they are as old as God, right? If we say they are eternally old, then they are as old as God. Therefore, God must be dependent on time and space. Do you follow the logic of it? But if God created time and space, as difficult as this concept is, but once we accept it, that God created, that before there was time and space, there was only God, and that's what we believe, by the way, right? That in the absolute before, whatever that means, there was only God. Only when time started, right, was there God and time and space. In order to show that God created time and space, God sanctified certain parts of time and certain parts of space in order to show the fact that He created it. Because if He didn't create it, it couldn't be sanctified. Because sanctification is the fact that God created it. It's the touch of God, so to speak, sanctifies it. What is the sanctification of time? The Sabbath. Right? The Sabbath is the sanctification of one portion of time. So now there is Kodosh, Kedusha, and there is Chol, non-Kedusha. Right? The same thing He did with space. A certain portion of the world, of the universe that He created, He sanctified, and the rest He did not sanctify. But that shows the sanctification of that one portion of space shows the touch of God, because it's only if God touches it, if there is a connection. If space is eternally old, there couldn't be any kedusha in space either. Okay? So what is the space parallel to the Sabbath, to Shabbat? Shabbat is the sanctification of time. What is the equivalent in space? Yeah, Eretz Yisrael, the Beit HaMikdash, whatever. Right? Okay, but it's the kedusha. There are many levels of kedusha in space itself, but it all stems from the kedushas HaMikdash, right? And it's expressed Yerushalayim, Eretz Yisrael, and so on and so forth. Okay, so now we can understand, you know, very, very often we see an interconnection between the temple and the Sabbath. Like, what are the things that we are not allowed to do on the Sabbath? Those things that we did when we created, when we made the temple. What is the interconnection? Because in a way, if we speak about it abstractly, we can say like, the temple is like the Sabbath of space. Right? In other words, God sanctified time and space in the beginning. That is the original sanctity. However, we, human beings, right, who we were also created by God, and a portion of humanity was also sanctified in order to interact with it, with the sanctity of space and the sanctity of time. Right? So we say we Jewish people are the sanctified people. So we have a sanctified people, a sanctified space, and a sanctified time. Now we have the complete triangle here. Now, what is the interaction between people, the holiness of time, and the holiness of space? The interaction is that we can draw from that original sanctity of time and space and apply it to certain situations where, in a way, we are co-creators with God of sanctified space and sanctified time. Do you hear this idea? So, for instance, we can build a synagogue a 1,000 miles away from Yerushalayim, and it becomes a sanctified place. Where did he draw the sanctity? So you know what the oral tradition says? It all draws from Jerusalem. This is why all, you know, there is a statement which is very often misunderstood. All synagogues and holy places of the world eventually will become withdrawn into the temple. What's the idea behind it? We're not describing the physical transfer of synagogues to Jerusalem. The idea is that eventually the sanctity will be drawn back to its source. That's the idea behind it, right? So even though we build a synagogue 1,000 miles away, eventually it will come back to its source. But who decided to draw from the sanctity of space and build a synagogue in Brooklyn, for instance, or whatever? A human being, the Jewish people. So the Jewish people take that sanctity and become co-workers with God, co-partners with God in the creation of new sanctity. We do exactly the same thing with space, with time, I mean. We take the sanctity of the Sabbath, which is the essential, the source sanctity of time, and we decide when the holiday should be. Is it going to be today or tomorrow? Does Rosh Chodesh, is the beginning of the month, today or tomorrow? We make the decision. And without us, that sanctity wouldn't exist. So we become partners with God in the creation of sanctified time and space. Okay? So now, this is the reason why by Shabbat we say Baruch Atah Hashem Mekadesh HaShabbat. We don't mention the Jewish people. But when we mention the sanctity of the new month, or the sanctity of the holidays, we must mention the Jews first. Mekadesh Yisrael, since he sanctified the Jewish people, vehazmanim, this is why he sanctified time. Without the Jews, there would be no sanctification in time and space. It would be forgotten, the sanctification of time and space. We are the only ones who maintain it and co-create with that capacity, with that holiness. Okay? Now, the whole relationship between Hashem and the human beings is based on the idea of being partners. You know, there's a very famous statement in Chazal which says like this. A certain Roman general asked Rabbi Akiva. He was trying to make fun, to poke fun at the Judaism, and he said, why is it you must believe that God is perfect? So if he is perfect, he created a perfect world. You take a child who was created perfectly and after 8 days you circumcise him. What are you doing? You are saying that he wasn't perfect? Because if he was perfect, why are you perfecting him? Okay? This is what Tornos Rupa, the general, Roman general, asked Rabbi Akiva. So Rabbi Akiva answers him something very enigmatic. He says, well, something like, does bread grow on trees? Bread doesn't grow on trees. You have to take you have to harvest it, you have to plant it, harvest it, you have to grind it, bake it, right? And then you have bread. What does it mean? That's the point. The point is God created such a world of partnership. Because there would be no problem for God to make bread grow on trees, right? Why not? If apples can grow on trees, so bread can grow on trees. The idea is that God created such a world in which we should feel partners with Him, right? The way we have children, right, is by creating ourselves human beings. God would have no problem that human beings should just sprout out from the ground, right? The fact that God created a whole system that it's people who beget people, right? The Gemara says it. In order to show that Shlosha Shutafim Bo Adam, that there are three partners in the creation, which means that we should feel the partnership. Okay? Now, in reality, the whole concept of tefillah, prayer, is based on partnership. That's the only way to understand it. Because if you analyze prayer, it's extremely, extremely difficult. It's telling God how to run His world. Do you hear? What a chutzpah. Right? If you analyze it, you stand up there and you tell God, you know, in case you weren't planning to make me rich, I'm asking you to make me rich, right? And make me this, and make me happy, and make me that, right? Well, I mean, who are you to tell God how to run His world? And in case you had in mind there should be a war, I'm telling you that you make peace, no war. We are advising God, right? Or Avraham Avinu stands up and starts giving God advice when to destroy the city of Sodom. Wait, careful, if there are 10 righteous men, don't do it, right? Or Moshe Rabbeinu is giving advice to God whether he should or not destroy the Jewish people after the sin of the golden calf. I mean, where does it come from, that chutzpah to stand up and argue with God? That's where it comes from. When God says that, I want you to pray, God is saying, I want you to feel a partner in what happens in the world. So when you stand up there, that's what you are saying. God, didn't you make me a partner? Okay, here it is. Here is my part. I say that the Jews should be well. The Jews should have peace. You have other plans? Okay, I'm telling you my plan. Because after all, we are all responsible for what happens. We are partners. So the essence of tefillah is also partnership. More. The essence of Torah is partnership. This is the incredible part of it. It says in the Talmud that as long as Moshe Rabbeinu was alive, you know how Torah decisions were made. Torah decisions weren't made through the methodology of Torah. That you sat down and you say, what is the right Torah decision? That's not what you did. Right? You came to Moshe, and Moshe received the answer. That was the method as long as Moshe is around. Because Moshe is the receiver of Torah. He's not the decision maker of Torah. He's the receiver of Torah. And that's how he made decisions. Remember? Somebody comes to him, what happens with the inheritance of a daughter? So he didn't say, wait, let me sit down and think. He right away went to the source, because that's the nature of Moshe. Moshe is the mekabel ha-Torah. He's the receiver of Torah. But the day Moshe Rabbeinu dies, the system is changed forever. Torah is not received anymore. Statement in the Torah. The Torah itself tells you, Torah is not in heaven anymore. You can't receive it anymore. From now on, you make Torah decisions. Do you hear? So we have to sit down with the information we have. As a matter of fact, the Talmud says, on the day Moshe Rabbeinu died, thousands of halachot, of laws, were forgotten. And they had to sit, and they came. It says they came to Oshua and they said, hey, come on, you know, do your job. Aren't you the substitute for Moshe Rabbeinu? So tell us. He said, no. Torah is not in a, I'm not a receiver anymore. So we have to make decisions, okay? Somebody has to use the methodology of Torah. So we sit down and we make Torah decisions, okay? And we hope for the best, true? Well, not really. It's not that we hope for the best. We hope that by chance this is what God meant. It's not true. Listen to this statement in the Talmud. What about, says the Talmud, If we make a decision according to Torah methodology, remember, Moshe also taught us how to come to the decision, the methodology, and it does not coincide with what God had in mind, right? Says God, well, what can I do? They beat me. They decided otherwise. What does that mean? Isn't that partnership? That's the way God established his relationship with the Jewish people, that from now on, they make the decisions. They become partners. Okay? So do you hear that this point is a crucial point in the relationship between God and the Jewish people, the concept of partnership? The whole Torah is partnership, Tefillah is partnership, right? This is why Kiddush HaChodesh, the decision of when Rosh Chodesh is, that is the original mitzvah, which represents the whole relationship, which represents the partnership. HaChodesh Hazeh Lochem. Lochem, you make the decision, you become my partners. This is why this was chosen as the law to start the whole Torah. Because with that, you become the nation of Israel. The nation which becomes a partner with God in the receiving of the Torah. And therefore it's given here, not in Sinai. The Torah is usually given in Sinai. Because this is a precondition to become a Jewish people. Once we are a Jewish people, once we understood the concept of partnership, now we can come to Sinai and see what does our partner want, right? But before that, we have to be ready for the partnership. That's what this mitzvah is, okay? This is why this mitzvah was supposed to be the first statement in the Torah, okay? Well, that's a difference. You know, so what is the answer? So why didn't it start, you mean, from here? Okay, fine. So, but it's not. It's history of Torah. It's not essence of Torah. So really, it should be. So fine. So right, the first Rashi in Genesis answers the question that it's because of our relationship with the Gentiles. That's why we need it. If it would be just us, we really wouldn't need it, right? That's why you remember the answer of Rashi.
But
we need it in order to establish our relationship with the Gentiles.
Exactly.
Because they will claim. It's an example. We stole Israel. So we say, hey, wait a second. What do you mean? The whole world is God's. So in order for that to establish the right, the essential right of the Jewish people, it starts with Bereishis. But without it, Torah itself, Torah proper, is from here on.
But that really is...
I don't mean to say that's not Torah proper. You know, once God decides, it becomes Torah proper. But that was the original thought, so to speak. Yeah.
That really doesn't hold any weight because... You go to a non-Jew who says, you stole the land.
Yeah.
We say, no, we didn't, because look, it says in our book. And they say, oh, but our book
says good question. Exactly, it's a very good question. It says, how can you convince with our book, how can you change their argument? How can you counter-argue what they are saying? Right? Fine, I mean, if we would be speaking about Genesis, I would tell you an answer to this, yeah?
I would say, very simple, the answer is not from the Goy, the Jew. Mm-hmm. So we should know that we didn't steal the land belongs to us. You're never going to convince the Goyim. They're always going to say that we stole the land. Look at what they're saying today.
Not really. If you pay attention to the Rashi says clearly that with this Torah, you will be able to convince the Gentile. It's not true what you are saying. I know many people say what you say. That's really, it's not for the Gentile will never accept it. It's for you. It's for us to know for sure. That's not the point. Rashi says clearly it's for the Gentile. You bring him this book and he'll accept it.
After that, right. Yeah. Yeah. Speaking to a guy, and he said to me that the Arabs were claiming the land in the West Bank, but in fact the Arab nations had sent the Jewish people out of the countries around Israel, Syria, Iraq, Iran, that they owed us money and land, for which we expelled the Arabs from the West Bank. But that would be a similar situation, which I worked out, to the one that we had in Egypt, where we would reverse. We would say, well, you owe us our houses and our land because you pushed us out of Iran.
It's a very, very difficult argument. If you remember, we said you can't claim, you see, somebody owes you something, right? And you owe somebody else something. And say, well, now we are even, right? The Syrians pushed us out, but there are Palestinians living here. Can we push them out? They are living here. How can we push them out?
No, it's coming back to...
You can say, because the Syrians did something wrong to me, so I have a right to do something wrong to the Palestinians. You're saying it's a non sequitur, it doesn't follow.
I'm not saying that there's something wrong that's done. I'm saying that, say, for example, take Iran, that Iran took back a lot of Jewish land, a lot of Jewish houses.
Correct, so therefore?
So now we're saying that there are Arabs who are.
They all turn to their original truth. You know, the Muslim and the Christian all turn to the Jew as the original truth, which was changed. So I'm going to go to the Jew. So he speaks to the Jew. And one of the arguments that the Jew gives him for the truth of the our tradition is the fact, he says, that all the people in the world have a seven-day week. Right? Where does that come from? There is no eight-day week. There is no six-day week. Meaning the tradition was always accepted. And more, we know that the Christian changed. We have the tradition that the Christians changed the Sabbath for Sunday. And the Muslims changed it to Friday because they didn't want to have the same one as the Jew, because they have to show that they are different. So the only tradition is the Sabbath. The truth of the matter is that now they claim that the Rabbi Yehuda Levi, he must not have not known, there are some tribes that never heard about the seven-day week. So it's not 100% of the people in the world, it's probably 99.99% of the people, which is also pretty amazing, right? That there is no, that everybody took on the seven-day week, it's amazing. Because the 30-day month, you can say, well, it's an average. The 365-day year, more or less an average. The seven-day week makes no sense whatsoever. It would make much more sense a 10-day week. It just doesn't make sense. That's the argument that so he says just the opposite. There is the only tradition which there is that everybody accepts is that the Sabbath, the resting day, was the seventh day that the Jews kept. That's the only tradition that everybody agrees on. You know, that's an incredible thing. What do you mean? Well, first of all, yeah, it's not 365, by the way. Like, right, that's what, like, the Jewish calendar, for instance, doesn't have 365, right? Ever.
355.
Sometimes it's
a, yeah,
right.
The other thing you said was the Kedusha of Eretz Israel, I think I heard you say, emanates from the base of
Mikdash. That's correct. The essence of the Kedusha is the base of Mikdash.
You're saying that prior to the establishment of the building of
It says that it does. In our oral tradition, we have the statement that there is a stone in the Mokoim HaMikdosh whose sanctity is independent of everything. It's the Even Hashtiyah, it's called. Even Hashtiyah. Right, exactly. Right. And that is holy no matter what. We may not know its holiness, even if nobody knows where it is. But we know there is the place. Even if the Beis HaMikdosh wasn't there. But we already had an awareness that that is the source of all holiness. And even if the tabernacle is in the desert, the tabernacle is just drawing its holiness from that stone. Right? Except that stone, like, widens. The whole Beis HaMikdash becomes holy. Yerushalayim becomes holy. Eretz Yisrael becomes holy. But the focus of all the holiness is that Even Shasiyah.
Yeah.
No. Melech HaLaretz Kvodo, right? Kvodo means his presence. Well, it means his presence, which means we accept that his presence is all over, whether it's holy or unholy. It means holiness is not a condition for his presence. Holiness is a precondition for gilui, for openness of the presence, right? No. I don't mean the stone as a stone. I mean the place of the stone. The place of the stone represents that the touch of God, so to speak, in the words of the Talmud, the stone which started the world. There's a statement in the Talmud. So the touch of God somehow is associated with that Even, with that stone. That's the stone on which Yitzchak was offered. Right? All right. So that's what the Gemara says.
Yeah.
Why? Yeah, they have that tradition too. They follow the tradition. They claim that there is a holy stone there. And that it's all taken from us. I mean, they claim that they know that that's the stone in the mosque, right? In the what? In the dome. It's not a mosque. I didn't know that. Okay, now, from verse number 3. It gives you another mitzvah from verse number 3, but it's we don't have much time, so let me just add one more thing concerning the mitzvah of Kiddush HaChodesh, the establishment of the new month, and its association with the Jewish people, another idea of how is it so closely connected with the Jewish people? You know that in the blessing, we have a blessing that we say every month for the new moon. Especially when we go out in the first 2 weeks of the month and we thank God for the moon. And we have a prayer there. And we have the prayer, remember we spoke about it, that God should fill the flow of the moon. We are not satisfied with the flow of the moon. We're not happy. Right? Lemalot pegimat halevana. The fact that that there's a full moon sometimes, and sometimes it shrinks and it disappears and it starts all over again, we're not satisfied with that. We want that the moon should return to its original shape. And according to our tradition, the original shape of the moon is that the moon being independent, to have an independent light. You know, that according to our tradition, there was an original time when the moon had its own light. It's not just a reflection of the sun, but it had its own light. It lost it, right? But we are hoping for the eventual return of the independent light. Now, what does it mean, yeah? Oh, so again, so what do we care, right? What do we care? You can have a good life without the moon going back. So the point is, remember, we once spoke about... It's a method of prayer. You know what we mean? We mean the Jewish people. Because the moon represents the destiny of the Jewish people. The destiny of the Jewish people, from that point on, since when we left Egypt, according to our tradition, we didn't stay the complete time. You know that it says that we're going to, maybe tomorrow we'll have time to speak about it. They were supposed to stay 400 years. Right? The reality is that they stayed only 210 years. And one opinion in the oral tradition says that therefore, the exile is not finished. We have another 190 years to go. And 190 years, right, that's what's missing. 210 we were there, 190 years. So therefore we owe God the 190 years. And of course, wait. The idea is that you know that whenever, the Jewish people, they went through their infancy as a people. This is their infancy. The Torah is the infancy of the Jewish people. That now the nature of an infant's experiences is that whatever he goes through as a child has 1,000 times more impact than something that happens later on. Right? The same dog that barked at him when he was 2 years old, that became a traumatic experience that changed his whole nature, his whole character, 50 years later it happens, and next day he won't even remember it. Which means an experience in the infancy shapes the person. And later on, it's an experience, and that's all. The same thing is with the Jewish people. During their infancy, the infancy of the Jewish people is that now, it starts now, the 40 years in the desert, whatever happens to them, it's masse ovo simel lebonim, which means that whatever happens to them, it's traumatic. It shapes their nature forever and ever and ever. Okay? It's the infancy of the Jewish people. Now, since the Jewish people, had they stayed now during their infancy, 400 years in Egypt, then that would have fulfilled their character. But since they are missing 190 years, eventually, when they get older, the experience required is much, much longer to have the same impact that they would have had they stayed another 190 years. It says in the Gemara. The Gemara says that that's what we are still paying up. The few thousand years exile that we went through after that is just to make up the original 190 years. Okay? So it comes out according to this that at this point it's decided the Jews won't have a shleimut, a completion at this point. There will be ups and downs. And very, very often people might think, or they themselves will think, that's it, we are disappearing. Like the moon at the end of the month. That's it, it's gone. What happens next time? The next day it comes up again, and it becomes filled again, but again it shrinks. In other words, that the whole moon, the moon represents the Jewish people. That's why we have a lunar calendar, right? Because it represents the Jewish people. So when we ask, we are tired of it already, God. Can't you change it already? It's enough. Lemalot kibatam levana. Who are we asking for? For ourselves, of course. Yeah. That's exactly it. This is what represents the Jewish people. That vanity, that feeling of, we can be on our own, Ein shnei melachim mishtamshei b'keter echad. You know, we can make our own decisions, right? Which means we will make our decisions of right and wrong. That is the essence of the flaw of the Jewish people. Their flaw is when they decide not to accept the partner, the other one with the light. You understand what I mean? Which means that represents the flaw of the moon. We are not really saying that the moon has free will and it actually had a conversation with God. It's all representative. It represents, it's a symbol of the flaw of the Jewish people. Okay? And therefore they lost their light, but they'll regain it. Okay?
The moon is just reflection of the night of the sun.
Right, that's what it becomes now. Yeah, go ahead.
It's interesting you say it's we're lacking 190 years of the what should have been in Egypt.
Yeah.
Could that have been amplified 10 times to about roughly 1,900 years?
We don't know. I mean, that's a speculation. That's pure speculation. It could be. By the way, you know, in the Haggadah of Passover, it says, we thank God that God, I must say it in Hebrew because it's crucial, the Hebrew word, God chishev. You know what chishev means? He figured out et ha-ketz. Ketz. The word ketz means the end. If you figured out the numerical value of ketz, chishev et ha-ketz. He figured out the 190 years. Kates, Kuf Tzadik is 190, which means he figured out that the 90 years that we couldn't stay there, because had we stayed another second it would have been too late. So God had to cut off the 190 years and he'll pay us back later on. So you had to make a whole chishuv, right? A whole account with 190 years. Chishuv et hakeitz. In the Haggadah of Passover. I can't... in the middle somewhere. Right? Before the matzah.
Before the matzah.
Why? Because of the 400 years that we were supposed to be in Egypt. Right. Okay. All right. Yeah. What? It's a big letters. Okay. All right.